Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
My reporting record isn't perfect. I mean, I was wrong about WMD because I think my sources were wrong.
Former New York Times correspondent Judith Miller on this program on Wednesday. Today is not just Friday, it's follow-up Friday. We are using part of our Friday programs this summer to follow up and dig a little deeper on some things that came up briefly during the week. The first one for today sparked a lot of intense feelings. Judith Miller, of course, is the former Times correspondent who wrote 10 of the 12 articles the New York Times later apologized for before the war, leading up to the war in Iraq, mostly on WMDs. And she's the one who spent 85 days in prison for refusing to reveal Louis Libby as the anonymous source who leaked Valerie Plame's identity to her. She was here primarily this week to discuss her new article about the NYPD's anti-terrorism unit, written for the City Journal, the publication of the conservative think tank, the Manhattan Institute. But I also wanted to see if she had any regrets or new thoughts about her pre-war Times reporting. And her answers to questions about that were actually pretty astonishing to me. In this clip that we're about to play, I had just asked her about the Times' apology for not being skeptical enough about the WMD claims in their articles before the war, and discovered that she did not think that it applied to her.
The Times apologized. It didn't blame the reporters. It never did that. That happened on kind of the blogs and the internet. If you read that statement very carefully, it says everyone lacked skepticism. Now,
do you not feel that way about yourself in retrospect?
No, I think that because I had worked in Iraq for so long and I had done reporting on the genocide and the use of chemical weapons in Iraq, and I had every reason to believe on my own, through my own experience with Saddam Hussein and his vile regime, that that they would use such weapons if they had them. I believed that the intelligence estimates were right. I think Hillary Clinton has said more or less the same thing. I know her husband has.
Judith Miller from this program Wednesday, and with me now to follow up and discuss the place of Judith Miller in journalism after the New York Times are Geneva Overholser. She's chair of public affairs reporting for the University of Missouri School of Journalism. She was the ombudsman for the Washington Post and was a member of the New York Times editorial board, also a contributor to the book What is Good Journalism? How Reporters and Editors Are Saving America's Way of Life, just published by the University of Missouri Press. And Daniel Okrant, writer and editor who was the first public editor or ombudsman at the New York Times from October 2003 to May of 2005, and collected his columns in Public Editor Number 1, The Collected Columns, with reflections, considerations, and even a few retractions of the first ombudsman of the New York Times. That book came out from Public Affairs last year. He also, by the way, invented rotisserie league baseball, but I don't think we'll talk about that today.
Oh, come on.
Maybe a little. Daniel, welcome back. My kids only, they collect like 43 different rotisserie teams in April and then don't follow any of them.
I plead guilty.
Daniel, Geneva, welcome back, both of you.
Great
to WNYC.
To be
and Geneva, I thought that was quite a distinction in the clip that Judith Miller made there, that the Times apologized for the institution's lack of skepticism, but did not blame the reporters, even though she wrote or co-wrote 10 of the 12 articles in question. Do you even understand that distinction?
Actually, Brian, I found that very interesting. I didn't realize that Judith Miller says that she sort of understands what she did as having been honorable. She believes that the assessment was right. I find that striking. I didn't know she felt that way. But in terms of the Times apology, I think she has a point. I mean, of course, her role in it was enormous, but the Times did apologize institutionally, and while I think they should have named her, I also think they have institutional responsibility. I mean, credulity, it takes two to publish credulity, you know, a reporter and a newspaper, and there are editors, and her sins were certainly credulity and an over-reliance on anonymous sources, but the Times was part of it.
Daniel Okrant, give us some background on the Times' apology at the time. What did they apologize for specifically, and what would the implications have been, even implicitly, for Miller's responsibility?
Well, the apology, the editor's note that ran in May of 2004, was really, I think, more than anything else, an effort to get the story behind them. The editors of the Times knew that the paper had failed miserably in its coverage in the months leading up to the invasion of Iraq and in the immediate aftermath. And this was, I think, a way to, you know, simply say, let's close that chapter. Judy Miller is right, legalistically. She was not named. It is in the Times' style and habit, and has been for as long as I can remember, that when it has published an editor's note or a retraction or even a simple correction on page A2, no one is ever named. The newspaper as a whole takes responsibility for it. But as Geneva said, Judy wrote 10 of the 12 pieces. She clearly is implicated in it, even though there wasn't a formal indictment from the paper itself.
So is this a little dense, a little obstinate to completely distance herself from the Times as an institution, given her central role in reporting those stories?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, Daniel, you can too.
Certainly a self-styled, difficult person. So, yes, it's obstinate. I think it's a case that holds together. It's a little hard for me to believe she doesn't have any regrets about it.
In that clip, she wrote off responsibility for being more skeptical than the Clintons had been, or resting on her past experience with the brutality of Saddam Hussein. And she had written a book about Saddam Hussein years earlier and, you know, had a lot of knowledge that, as she put it, he was the kind of guy who would use WMDs if he had them. But I note, Daniel, that a few other news organizations, notably the Knight Ridder chain, and I wonder if you ever did a comparison as ombudsman, did raise serious questions in their reporting about the evidence being offered to back up the WMD and Al-Qaeda connections. So is there is it a kind of complacent answer by Judith Miller?
I think it is. I think that in the clip that you played where she said that it was her sources who were wrong, we're responsible for our sources as journalists, particularly responsible when they are anonymous sources,
exactly.
Where there is no paper trail or no trail of names that anyone can follow to find out who said what that leads the reporter to this impression.
That's the particularly difficult part about this. I mean, she received this information excessively unquestioningly, and then she passes it on to us without attribution, which means we don't have the tools to question it.
Here's another clip. A number of listeners called or wrote in to say Miller has no credibility with them to talk about her new writing on the NYPD or anything else because she got those earlier stories wrong and because they see her as ideologically driven. Now, some of the listeners said our credibility was also diminished with them for even having her on the show. Here I asked Miller about the ideology charge. You say not ideological. You know a lot of people on the left in this country would disagree, and your writing since you left the Times, at least that I've come across, has been mostly for publications identified as conservative, like the Wall Street Journal editorial page and now the Manhattan Institute City Journal. Does that say something about you being with an ideological camp on foreign affairs?
No, I think what it says is that I've also been writing for the Los Angeles Times, and I don't think that people would say that that's an ideological right-wing paper. I write for the people who are interested in the subjects that I propose, and I've proposed articles on these themes to a lot of people, and some publications are more interested than others. I'm politically independent. I've always been, and people who have other views are entitled to interpret my writing as they see it, but that's what I consider myself. And independence in such a polarized environment as we have today is oftentimes a very lonely place to be, and it's sometimes misinterpreted.
Judith Miller from Wednesday's show. There was one internal edit within that answer, as there was in the previous answer, by the way, to take out some irrelevant material. But Geneva, do you accept that answer? She basically said, I'm independent, and if it happens to be mostly conservative publications that are interested in my stories, that's no reflection on me. Do you find that a credible response?
It distresses me a little bit. It seems perhaps a bit disingenuous, but my view is that ideologically forthright reporting can be useful, but I think the truth in packaging thing is the distressing thing. If she's writing for the Wall Street Journal editorial page and for the Manhattan Institute, then there is those two organizations, the consumer knows what to make of them. I think if they are publishing her views. The fact probably is that she ought to be understanding that that's the implicit statement. I'm not quite sure why she isn't willing to be more forthright about that.
Daniel, any thoughts on this?
Well, yeah, I would defend her on this one, although the point I think that she's missing is it's not the publications who are interested in her subjects that publish her. It's the publications who are willing to publish Judy Miller. Publications on the left, certainly, or those that have large readerships on the left, will not touch her. So, you know, she is perforce pushed into publications that were on the right. You go back enough years, she used to write for the New York Review of Books. I think that Geneva is right. You can identify the at least the position of the people who are publishing it to get an idea of what the writer is up to. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the writing itself is ideological. Every reporter has a set of beliefs, and very few good reporters, and I think very few even bad reporters, force those beliefs into their work.
Yeah, but she's not doing reporting so much now as.
Opinion writing,
commentary, or opinion writing, and there the question of one's beliefs, whether they're partisan or not, is central.
Well, yes, but opinion writing is what it is. It reflects the opinion of the writer, and we know what the writer is thinking. So why should that disqualify her for commentary?
No, that's sort of my point. But I think it is. It seems to me as if she's trying to say, you know, I'm writing, and I'm not. It's not because I have certain views. People are publishing me, but these are views people are publishing. I think the real question that the consumer of anything she writes needs to ask himself or herself is. Okay, are the sources on the record? Do I have reason to believe she was skeptical enough? All those are the two things that were raised by her previous work. This is a skilled reporter who, for three decades before she ran into this terrible episode, I don't mean she ran into it, obviously she was part of it, but, you know, she has a great record, and those are the two questions I think news consumers need to ask themselves.
And so what about the idea of even having her on a program like this to discuss her post-New York Times reporting? Obviously, at least some listeners thought that was bad judgment on our part, and I take the question very seriously. You know, our thinking was this. Judith Miller would not come on during the last few years. We had tried to get her to discuss the issues surrounding her. She was now being made available by the Manhattan Institute to discuss the NYPD, and I took the opportunity to have her on and talk about both things. We labeled the magazine that she was now writing for as, you know, having the Conservative Institute think tank affiliation, and I found her answers very revealing about herself and those questions, the one we've been replaying here this morning. But I acknowledge that it raises an issue of having someone seen by many of our listeners as discredited to talk about new reporting. Although one of the reasons that we did have her on was also because I thought that there was very interesting stuff in that article about Ray Kelly and the NYPD and his relationship with the FBI and with Bratton in L.A. Give a take on this. Why should a listener trust her new reporting given all we've discussed already? And how would either of you as a producer go about deciding whether to have her on?
I hate to do this, Brian, but I'm going to defend you on this one. I think that we all can listen to whatever anybody has to say and know where that person is coming from and put that into our judgment of the validity of what the person has to say. Should you not have Dennis Kucinich on his show because he has strong left-wing views? No. You hear the name Judy Miller, which has become a brand name of a sort. The listeners who objected know what they believe they know what Judy Miller stands for, and they can hear it. Through that particular microphone.
Precisely. It was a smart, cogent interview. I mean, your questions were interesting. I learned a lot from it. I'm delighted you had her on. That doesn't mean I agree with her, nor I'm sure does one individual or another in your listenership. But as Daniel says, they have their own ability to bring to the interview what they know.
And people will question whether or not I was tough enough on her, as some of the comments referred to. But I did want to acknowledge that response on the part of our listenership and also talk about some of the issues that...
If I could add one thing to it, I think that it's important as well to bear in mind that Judy Miller, as I said, has become the brand name for all the bad reporting done by many scores of news organizations before the war in Iraq began, and that a lot of people who have fingered her as the devil incarnate probably never read a word that she said.
Absolutely right. And while you're right, Brian, that the Knight Ridder papers did an extraordinary job, even their own newspapers, many of them didn't run it because the tide was so much in the opposite direction. And it's important to remember that she was far from alone in this, although I think her work probably had more impact than any other individual reporters.
Geneva Overholzer is the chair in public affairs reporting for the University of Missouri School of Journalism, a former ombudsman for The Washington Post, former member of the New York Times editorial board, and a contributor to the book, What Good is Journalism? Oh, did I say before, what is good journalism? It's really, what good is journalism? Is that it?
That's right, that's it.
How Reporters and Editors Are Saving America's Way of Life, published by the University of Missouri Press. That's a big claim. And Daniel Okrent, who, besides inventing Rotisserie League Baseball, which we never did talk about, was the first public editor at the New York Times and collected his columns in a book called Public Editor Number 1, published by Public Affairs last year. Thank you both very much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
it was a pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue to have your say at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show for our comments page. Coming up in a minute, more follow-up Friday. We'll follow up on something that Michael Eric Dyson said on the show this week about how racism can make the victims physically ill. Stay with us.